I look at a founder as a warrior. So I don't know any general that still wets his pants when bombs go off.
Hello and welcome to V for Visionaries podcast with me, Richard Ward. I am an award-winning serial entrepreneur with over 35 years experience in the beauty and media world. And I've built and sold many businesses. But today I'm most interested in finding out who are the movers and shakers in business, what makes them so successful, and why certain cream rises to the top.
And me, Rosamund Stenhouse. I am an award-winning fourth generation of entrepreneurs. I have spent several decades working with all aspects of land, delivering new towns and large-scale landmass for development. I now work with national and international entrepreneurs, scaling, improving sales, and expanding their business. This is the podcast where bold ideas meet business brilliance.
Yes, and each week we'll be sitting down with trailblazing entrepreneurs and industry leaders to uncover the strategies, the stories, and the secrets behind some of the world's most exciting business ventures. Today, we have the pleasure of welcoming Gerald Durham, a serial entrepreneur of 40 years and multi-dimensional venture capitalist. He is a self-proclaimed rebel, once declaring his company an unwoke VC, described by his peers as an ethical, wise, facts-driven leader. Please welcome Gerald Durham. So, Gerald, what do you think about that intro?
Oh, I love it. Who could complain?
So, look, what we have a tradition on this podcast. There's one that's always a tradition at the beginning and one at the end. The first thing we always like to do, it's clear to us that you have been hugely successful and we can't wait to tuck into your story. But we like to take you right the way back to the start. So could you take us back a little bit from your childhood? What kind of family you bought into? Have you got a finance background? I'll let you take it from there.
You know, I came from a really poor family in East Los Angeles, and I'm Hispanic and Mexican. And so at the time, you know, we were good factory workers. Maybe the greatest thing we could aspire to be would be a union supervisor. And that's what I came out of. A very rich, wealthy lawyer, my first mentor, told me that God had a plan and purpose for my life, and that if I figured out what that was and I just pursued it, there would be nothing that could stop me. And this guy rode around in a limousine when there weren't any people riding around in limousines. And so he became a family friend and just showcased this idea that there's a better life out there. And I think for me, I never bought into the view that my race or my position in life could stop me. So I was never looking. I think from day one, I never bought into social justice. Never.
So you're introduced and start, your eyes are starting to open through this wonderful family. I mean, what a wonderful experience that must have been. And that's a little gift in itself, isn't it? To meet somebody like that. How old were you then? So what are we talking, 13, 14, 15 or younger?
Yeah, probably around that age. And I just think he planted a seed inside me that started to grow.
So how'd you get that seed to grow? Where'd you go from the age of 18?
You know, I started my first startup at 23 years old, young and dumb. I've worked for somebody one time and I got fired after 6 months. And I always have been the type of person that I think I could do everything better. And so that was a state of ignorance when I started my first venture.
And what was that?
It was a staffing company in Newport Beach, California.
Let me ask you, just flicking back a second, would you say that you found authority very difficult?
Yeah, I've always been a rebel. I've never just accepted the status quo. I think I've always had a good gut instinct on things that I've learned to trust over time. And you know, it's kind of like today when they say follow the science, I go, what science?
So how did you do with that first company at 23? How did it go?
So for 1 year, I made no money. And I had to drive a delivery truck at nighttime just to pay the bills. And honestly, I was so stressed out of my mind. And the only way I would feel better is to go out and party and get drunk with my friends and kind of forget about my troubles. But then, you know, the next day you're not feeling that great. And so after a year, I dug into my religious roots and I thought, okay, God knows something about business.
Jared, I've got to stop you there, because for our listeners and viewers, the question that we're all wondering is what would in I'm sure the list could be endless and is endless, but what was the nutshell ballpark of what you changed?
It was a disruptive idea of how to go to market. So in the staffing business, it's like real estate, where in real estate, there's a listing and there's a buyer, and yeah, it's a commission-based thing, and they get that. The idea was that in executive search, some companies are paid a retainer up front, the big firms like Korn Ferry. And the idea was, what if we did that at kind of a micro level? And at the time, this was pre-internet. So, you know, if you were looking for a new, the area of specialty was marketing and technology, and there was things changing and there was a shortage of those people. And back then, if you wanted to hire somebody, you put a really expensive ad in the newspaper and you might have to pay for it for, you know, 3 or 4 months. And if you didn't hire a person, they didn't give you your money back. So around all of that, we came up with a clever way to market using technology that was just starting to take off, and it changed everything. We started getting our fees up front. Just a whole lot of things. So what I learned was this. In every startup, you start out flawed. That's why 90% fail.
Yeah.
If you go to market flawed, you're going to fail. And so in this process, when you're working through your ideas through ideation and iteration, you got to go from flawed to viable.
Define flawed, please.
Flawed is it won't work. So you have this, you have this idea, a solution around a problem. But yeah, but yeah, when we're, you know, today in our incubator, we're looking at every idea through the lens of Lean Business Canvas. And we're going, there's 9 views of this thing. And so immediately we know every model's flawed. Like, for instance, you know, you think about like Airbnb. Okay. Yeah. When they started out, it was a very flawed idea. YouTube was a very flawed idea. If you just look at, and what they had to do is they figured out, some of these went to market and then figured it out. Yeah. Others figured it out before they go to market.
If you're lucky enough, because you've just said, I'll just pick you up. You said most businesses fail 95%, which is what we all know. They all fail because their business model is flawed. Unless you're lucky enough to have the time to put it right quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a process. And I think that, you know, what's interesting is I'm a student of failure.
Absolutely.
So a lot of people, you know, if a lot of people, there's a million different ways to be successful. You know, on LinkedIn, everybody's sharing their opinion about what it takes to be successful. I've really focused on why are people failing. And for me, I've narrowed it down to 4 things. I don't do those 4 things.
What are they?
And the first thing that I never fail at, I never do anything unless I understand the purpose of it and have deep, meaningful purpose. 2, I spent a lot of time developing my faith. I don't allow doubt, fear, or worry into my thought life. The minute it comes in, I know how to evict it. 3, I understand how to get in front of the right customers and close them. So I build strategies around there. So customer acquisition, or RevOps, as we would call it today, is something that I never fail at. And 4, I know how to get in front of the right investors when needed and attract them and close the deal. So those 4 things, I just focus on not screwing those 4 things up. And of course there are details of that, but yes, that's what I focus on.
Gerard, here's one stat that I want to throw at you. 30% of businesses survive after 10 years. So why do you think that is? I'm only going to put you on the spot.
Well, I think it's simple. I think that is the landscape. The thing that gets you there never will keep you there.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. That's
so
interesting.
You know, as the especially the digital landscape changes. And see, you know, as a venture studio, we're really in the turnaround business. So in our studio, we get all kinds of ventures that have been in business a long time. And the things that they were doing that got them to where they are will not take them to where they want to go. So why does a company go out of business? You run out of cash. That's usually the reason why you go out of business. You run out of cash. Why you run out of cash? Well, you weren't really good, or you stopped being good at landing the right customers. Okay. Why can't you land the right customers? You somewhere along the line, whatever your marketing is doing is not driving traffic to your site. You're not converting that traffic into leads, and you're not converting those into sales.
Gerald, that's I have another theory. Uh-huh. My theory is that your company, a founder's company, is the direct reflection of who they are inside. So whatever their liabilities are, whatever their flaws, whatever their assets are, it will come out over the years. Whether it's, you know, pride, whether it's a refusal to delegate, whether it's a refusal to evolve fast enough, they may be lightning speed in the early years. But those character aspects to them tend to be the things that are their downfall, whether it is pride or whether it's an inability to adapt or whether it's a very narrow thinking or it's alcoholism or it's some kind of, you know, entrepreneurship creates, squeezes a person within an inch of their life. And I think it really alters people. The journey of entrepreneurship really alters because you have to become the company. Can you tell me of what you think of that and tell me if I'm wrong? Or
look, there's a lot of different playbooks out there. There's, I think, endless list of, you know, what it takes to succeed. So here's my simple analogy. You know, in golf, there's good golfers, there's scratch golfers, and there's people that are not. The only, if you're not good in golf, it's because you don't know how. Now the question is, are you willing to learn how? So, you know, there's a lot of this thing, if you've been around for 10 years, you can't teach old dog new tricks. I think that's true sometimes. And so if they're not willing to learn, then let them fail. Let them fail. So they're going to pay the ultimate price. For those that get to a place, you know, let's say that it's a small business and they've been around 10 years and their revenues hit 5 million and now it's dropped to 2 million and they've gone through a lot of layoffs and all of that. What's really happened is their customer acquisition strategy stopped working. The things that they were doing that have always worked stopped working. And they have, it's not like the things that everybody does that work is a secret. They were arrogant in their thinking and thinking that what they were doing, well, it got us this far for this long and I'll be darned if I'm in it. Well, you know, my response is then go broke and die.
Love it.
It doesn't affect me one bit, but you're not the exception to the rule.
Yeah.
So you're not the exception. Every single year, I have to adjust my startup playbook around the, it's mostly the digital changes.
Yes.
Okay. If I don't do that, guess what? I'll get left behind. I don't want to get left behind. So what I have to do now, there's a plethora of things that people will tell you to do, but I'm really, you know, one of the things that I really know inside and out is RevOps. So it stands for revenue operations. It's the modern look at sales and marketing outside of their silos put together, but there's three main components, whether you're B2B, B2C or B2B2C, doesn't matter. What are you doing to drive traffic to your website? What you're doing is either working or it's not working. Okay. Once you drive traffic to your website, what are you doing to convert that traffic into leads? It's either happening or it's not happening. And then once you have leads, what are you doing to convert those leads into a win rate? So for instance, if you're a B2B SaaS company, okay, and your goal is to be on a $10 million run rate, and let's say your sales team has a win rate of 40%, and let's say ARR and the ideal customer is 200,000 or ARPA is 200,000. So you land a customer, that's the revenue they'll bring you annually. It really comes down to how many appointments does my company have to get every month to be on a $10 million run rate? When an owner doesn't know that number, it's because they've been negligent.
It seems so obvious.
Yes, I totally agree. Let me ask you something that certain industries are a lot more stressful and require a lot more guts than other industries. You moved into the VC area. That is a very, very tough industry. If for listeners, any of the VCs that are starting out, or founders, here's another question, founders coming to a VC, how on earth do you approach a VC and how do you start a VC?
So, you know, most people that are VCs come from wealth and or, you know, a circle of friends or, you know, at least in America or out of Silicon Valley, which I didn't have any.
I can see, Gerald, you take great pleasure in saying you do not come from Silicon Valley.
Oh, no. But we're reforming it. We're reforming it. So I looked at, you know, in the neighborhood I lived in, there were a lot of VCs. And when we compared results, I thought, you're bragging about these companies that you funded and how great they are. But when I'm looking at their revenue, which they never tell you, your revenue is pathetic. So I'm looking at the result and I started understanding how the machine worked. And so think about this. VCs are perfectly okay with 90% of their portfolio failing. They're perfectly okay. Their LPs who invest in their fund, they're looking for a 3X, right, return. The VCs are looking for 100X. The LPs are looking for 3X. In a smaller fund with less than 100 million in it, which that would be a smaller fund, those LPs, those investors into the fund are lucky to get 1X or even their return. So the problem is it's not a win-win. You know, there's the founders, there's the LPs, and there's the VCs. Well, I don't know any managing partners that are poor because you're making 2% of the fund. So even if everybody fails, you're getting rewarded really nicely. So I immediately, like pretty much everything I do, I thought, well, why do I have to follow those rules? I don't like those rules. And so at the time, two decades ago, there was something called a venture studio. And there was only three or four of them in the world. They were just getting started. It was kind of a deeper incubator where they'd take companies, a lot of times turn them around. So kind of sometimes bordered on a hybrid, like private equity. And so when we started out two decades ago, we reimagined everything. We looked at who is the ideal company for us. So one, I understood that most startup founders have wishful thinking and, you know, they're kind of Pollyanna and they'll say anything to get funded, but most of them the results never, ever happen. So I'm not betting on those guys. So we looked at to get into our venture studio, you have to have $1 million in annual revenue, because by the time you get to $1 million, you're in the top 7%.
Are you really?
Get to 10 million, there's only 1% of startups that could do 10 million. And if you're gonna be venture backed, you have to do 100 million. That's part of the formula. And only 0.04% could ever hit that number. So we looked at things different. I don't want to tell our secrets of what we're doing different, but we looked at what we didn't like. We created a system around a different set of rules. And we have been, you know, and so for our first, you know, decade of running a venture studio, that's why we saw about 90% of our portfolio succeeding. And I took on kind of this mission of going into the marketplace to stop the failure. So to be for something, you have to be against something. What am I against? Failure. To stop failure, you have to understand why people fail. And even if I back it up a step, like an idea with poverty versus prosperity, the thing I learned early on is poverty isn't how much you have in your bank account, neither is prosperity how much it's a state of mind. And that's what that lawyer taught me. You become prosperous in your mind before you, and I made my first million in my mind before it ever hit my bank account. It's a way of thinking. And so one of the things that I could tell you, I asked God early on, I says, I want you to brainwash me. Now, what did I mean by that? Wash me clean of all my stupid ideas that will cause me to fail and give me your wisdom. If I believe in God, he's been around for a long time. If I look at the people that follow him, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the disciples, they were all entrepreneurs. Even Jesus was an entrepreneur. So I thought, you know, if I believe in the creator, and if I believe that he'll communicate with me, then I want to learn everything I can from him.
I completely understand what you're saying, but that is not going to make a company last. That just basically feeds your soul and creates life and energy and light and attracts. Here's my question. Is the business model of the VCs you just described, which is a sort of, it's a crash and burn business model is what they've got. They're basically, tell me if I'm wrong, it's like a sieve. They'll just put as much as they can in the sieve on terms that are diabolical for the founder.
Not necessarily. They're
well,
you know,
I mean, come I on. Think... Everyone knows that the last, and I'm going to throw this at you because you're not in this mix, and I want to stress that it's evident, but VCs for founders or entrepreneurs are seen as the last resort in, you know, for many thinkers.
No.
Well, let me explain why.
Almost every startup founder wants VC.
No, not everyone. Most of them.
I didn't say everybody, almost everyone. And I'll just tell you how I'm very connected, you know, in.
But Gerald, hear me out. There's a reason what I'm saying. I don't mean to be disrespectful in any way. What I'm saying is there'll be many entrepreneurs or founders have such bad experiences or VCs have such bad reputations at just basically taking companies, squeezing them dry, doing whatever they can to get the profit out. If they win, great, off they go. Your model of what you're describing is a lot more, it's a lot more labor intensive. It's a lot more thought out. You're trying to make everyone together we stand, divided we fall in that battle mentality, which is what I completely concur with.
Well, I probably see it a little different, but I'll tell you why I see it different. On LinkedIn, which is where I spend my most time, social media, in the VC space, in the United States, I'm number 15. So I'm one of the top influencers on LinkedIn. If Favcon puts out a report of the top 50 influencers in VC, I'm number 15. We attract about 40,000 founders to our site every month. But I think it would be a lot easier if somebody would just give them a bunch of money. So when somebody's going for their first round, it's pre-seed. You know, I think there's four things you got to get good at if you want pre-seed. You got to have a killer deck. You have to have a killer pitch. Your data room has to be in order. And you have to understand how to attract VCs, which most people suck at. They just completely suck at. There's a reason why only a half of a percent of those that want VC get it. It's a tiny percentage. If you're trying to get into like a top accelerator like Y Combinator or one of those, which are excellent, only 1% gets in. So you have everybody wants the easy route. The thing is, they're not going to get it. They're not going to get it. And why? Because they don't know how.
Can you share how?
Well, first, with us, we don't fund anybody we don't mentor.
That's interesting.
You know why? We lose our rear. We already know what's coming in. So we understand that. So the person that's just after a quick check, not through us, go someplace else. We're the buyer, they're the seller, right? And the problem is that most startup founders have wishful thinking. How do I know that? Because even when they get funded, 75% still fail. So they fooled most of the VC because most of the people making decisions aren't operators, they're money managers. And there's a particular kind of investor that we're looking for. You know, I'm not going to break down the LPs, but there's four or five different types of LPs. The ones that we want are operators.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. God.
Like, I can tell you this. I have never once ever reached out to an investor to invest with us.
I was going to ask you, actually, it's on my list of questions here, and I've written it in capitals before we went on air, and it says, where'd you get your investors from?
Yeah, so I know how to attract them. You know why? I don't have the problem. They do.
Can I ask you, Gerald, how many companies are you invested in at any one time?
We never say.
Oh, I've asked a brilliant question then. Is it in the hundreds?
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you, we've been doing it 20 years.
But let me ask you this. So what's rushing through my mind, which is always what happens when I'm talking to mega successful people on this podcast. So just picking up on something you said, you don't invest in anybody that you can't mentor or that they don't want mentoring. You get very heavily. How on earth can you mentor all those companies?
Yeah, so we get, you know, like 40,000 founders that come to our site.
Yeah.
Okay. All of them want to meet with one of our venture partners or myself, which we're not going to meet with them. Okay. So we have something called Startup School. We have a playbook. Okay. So we're operating in our playbook. So there's something called Startup School. We've made it free. There's three courses. They're on demand. And so anybody that's kind of a do-it-yourself, go to Startup School. And so I would say that's where the vast majority go to. So that's the first thing. Okay. We do free startup clinics. We do them every couple of weeks where we get on with a large group of founders and we talk about the ins and outs of landing customers, landing investors, and kind of what our advice is. The next thing is we have something called Startup Church.
Yeah.
So we have about 700 people. And every Thursday, we bring investors and myself, and we're mentoring. The step up from that is our startup incubator. And that's the first time anybody's going to have real mentorship from me.
Okay.
And so in our startup incubator, we usually have three cohorts going at the same time. And I'm taking 12 to 20 founders through a process when we're going through our playbook's building blocks of how to learn what all the things that go into landing customers and all the things that go into landing investors. So these are companies that they could be solo founders, co-founders, pre-revenue, post-revenue. What they all have in common is they have less than $1 million in revenue. And then when somebody's made it through that and they could have, and they get to a place where they have $1 million in revenue, then if they align with a lot of things that we're looking for, then we'd bring them into the venture studio. And in our venture studio, we like getting them around 1 to 2 million. We like that spot because that's where most companies get stuck.
Can I just ask you, 1 to 2 million, that's turnover. Sorry, Roz. I know we're both so engaged in this. We've both got so many questions to ask. You never once talk about profit. So
I'm about to ask that, but I want
you know, 1 to 2 million. You're just talking turnover.
Yeah.
You never have once on this pod, which I think is so interesting. That actually, when you're taking them on, as long as they, I feel like you're saying, as long as they've got a turnover of 1 or 2 million, I can do something with that, regardless of what profit they're making.
They come to us. I mean, what really happens with a founder? This is when you're digging deep into what's really going on. So a founder has built a team. Let's say they get to $5 million in revenue. And then something changes and what used to work stops working.
Mm.
Okay. So the very first thing, and so all of a sudden revenue drops substantially. Okay. Now their expenses are still up, you know, so let's say they had a 30% margin and, but all of a sudden that's getting affected. So what's the first thing that they have to do? They could cut a lot of people and they might have to do a layoff. But usually we see the founder going, you know what, we've worked hard at you know, developing these people. So I'm just not going to take home a paycheck for a while until we could turn this thing around. That's the first thing that happens. Well, here's what happens at home. So at home, the spouse, the family unit is enjoying this lifestyle. All of a sudden that money's not coming in, you know, and there's a tension and most of the founders' homes, because after a while of this, the spouse is saying, why are we paying all those people when we're the ones not getting paid? So there's this, so there's things that happen behind the scene that I'm a student of pattern recognition. And so I really understand where the pain is. So I sit and I look at, okay, when we look at the company, is what's the model? What's the potential? Like, there's certain kind of companies that I like. Of course, when you're building revenue, you want to build it profitably. What happens to their profit, though, is because usually if revenues went south, there's only so much of their expenses that they're able to or willing to adjust. Sure. So, you know, what we're looking at is profitable revenue always. And so like trauma surgeons, the very first thing we're doing is save the life. What has to happen to save the life? Here's the things that have to get in place. And then we look at how would we lay over our startup playbook. And so that's what the process is.
What percentage? So let's say I'm a founder, I'm coming to you. Gerald, I'm up shit street, gift of desperation is here, I'm all ears, tell me what I need to do, I'm willing to go and do anything. What percentage will I retain of my business at the end of my term with you?
I don't think there's a standard answer for that, ever.
Is it, do I still have 60%? Or is it as low as 30%?
I think you're looking for, I mean, ideally, like I'll give you an example. A company could come into us, we grow them to, let's say, 10 million.
Right.
And they have opportunities for investment. But at that point, they go, you know what? We don't want it.
Oh, they can get out. Okay, so what's the get out?
They're not in. I don't know what you think they're in.
Yeah, but you haven't done it all for free, have you?
No. We take a percentage of new revenue.
Yeah, I mean, it is business. Okay. I can see that. I totally understand. Let me ask you something. I'm sitting here thinking, how have you had time, and I'm assuming you have one, you might not, you might just be a complete free spirit, for a family?
Well, I've been married 34 years.
Okay, who is she? Tell me about her. She must be fabulous.
I don't think it's rocket science. You know, look at, I, at 5 o'clock, my day ends. I'm up at 4. I spend 2 hours with God talking, and I'm getting my plans together, which, you know, a lot of people would mock, but I don't care.
No, I do that too.
I have the fruit. I could care less.
No. It's a very sane, very logical approach. So you're 4 a.m., you're up. Sorry, 4 a.m., you're up.
Then I quit at 5. That's
studying,
my routine.
You meditate for an hour. What do you do then?
I go to work. But, you know, it's look at everything I'm building is for family.
Can I just flick back to your wife a second? I'm very curious about her. What is the attributes that your wife holds that allows you to be so patient with you? Yeah. That, you know, because she has to be an incredibly patient woman, and probably has had to cut her needs quite a bit to allow you to go out and have these, you know, this purpose.
Mm.
She must be an incredible woman to.
Well, she is. I mean, we both came from, you know, I would say she's an old farm girl. So, you know, but she's today a leader in a major health organization. She's in learning development. And, but what we both are not, is neither one of us are complainers. We're one. We're one. And so we are best friends. We're kind of, you know, creatures of habit. And so she's never, no matter what's happened, and we lost, you know, a couple of decades ago, I lost everything. And they got down to $9.
Sorry, how much?
$9.
Fantastic.
That's what you had left.
I was going to ask you a good story.
You've just touched on that. So the question I was going to ask you, which you just answered, well, first thing is, do you see, you are, aren't you? You're a true entrepreneur. Do you see yourself as an entrepreneur? You are, aren't you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And the next thing I was going to say before you just said that, sort of, my impression of you was that you actually haven't fallen on hard times. Everything that you seem to touch turned to gold, but you've now completely dismissed that. So are you the kind of entrepreneur, sort of, well, as Roz rightly says, in my view, we have the same view. There are different kinds of entrepreneurs. Are you the kind of entrepreneur that is willing to put the whole lot on black?
I don't know. I'm not, I don't take foolish risk, but I do take big risk. And the thing is that I look at, a founder as a warrior. So I don't know any general that still wets his pants when bombs go off.
See, our editor putting that in on the titles.
You know, I hang around with people that have a slight limp. That's who I trust. And Brilliant. If somebody doesn't have a slight limp, they've never been to battle. So most of us, if you've been to battle, you have a lot of scars.
Yeah,
and you understand what it means to be, you know, tested by fire. But look at, when I lost everything, here's why I wasn't worried. Prosperity is a state of mind. So that I told my son, the same mind that everything turned to go, I still have it. So watch this thing get rebuilt. It's just the circumstances. It's like a general who goes into battle and they lose one of the battles, but they haven't won the war. That's just part of battle. And so you're going to get wounded, and it's just part of it.
Yeah, I think in battle terms all the time. I think it's a very good way of thinking. So we, sadly, Gerald, because you are just fantastic.
You are. You are. Honestly, thank your you. Podcast lol.
Thank you. It's been a joy.
Anyway, Roz has got to, Roz.
So we have a tradition. We ask three questions. Richard's going to ask you the first one and put you heavily on the spot.
So we ask our guests three questions, same questions every week. You are, as you're in America, you are president for the day. What is the first thing, top of your mind, that you change?
The things that Donald Trump's going to do, I'd probably do most of those things.
So what is the first thing?
I would wipe out the deep state.
What's that?
The deep state are all of our government workers.
Yeah.
That don't do much for society. I would wipe out wokeness.
But funny enough, being a man of such faith, I'm surprised you are not more woke, actually.
Our whole branding was the non-woke VC. Okay, that was it. But today, every major tech company in the United States is wiping out their DEI departments. The people are shocked. They're shocked because they're like, our leaders, we drank the Kool-Aid from our leaders, and now they've all switched gears because this Donald Trump and Elon Musk and all these people that are reforming the United States have stepped up. And we're seeing this happen. I mean, in the UK, we're seeing major shifts happening where people are saying enough.
Sure.
Yes, yes. Now, Joe, I have a second question.
Second question.
For you. It's a very light and easy one. Music-wise, do you have an icon or someone that you have adored in the music industry your entire life? Or what kind of music do you listen to?
So I collect black gospel.
No.
I like old country, believe it or not. And I like, probably classic rock. And so, that's what I listen to. But, what's on my playlist is a lot of black gospel no one's ever heard of.
Oh, it's so cool.
So the third question, I was racking my brain to think what it was. We've done so many pods and I just had a mental blank, but it's just come back to me. I know exactly what it was.
Okay.
I know what your answer's going to be, by the way, before you say it. Who do you have to thank? Who do you have to thank? Who was your mentor? Who do you have to thank for your success?
So I'm very thankful to people who are authors because...
Who are...
Authors of books.
Authors, yeah.
Because I have a gigantic library. I eat up books and I consume books. And I just, and I'm an author too myself. I've written two books. But I would say that like when you're looking for mentorship, it's not like somebody, like a person always props up and is there. So for me, not being well connected and not, coming from the privileged, I've had to find mentorships through books. And so I'm always grateful. It's a lot of work to write a book. So I'm always grateful that these authors took time to take what was in their heart and put it out there for everybody else. And so really to this day, when we lost everything, I'll tell you this, I made a promise to God. I said, I understand that we're stuck in the desert. We know to not build our house here in the desert, in the wasteland. But when you restore resources to me, I'll dedicate the rest of my life to going back and helping people who are failing. And so that's really what I've done with my life. And, when you do that and people are hurting, they're thankful. And you become significant. Not because the significant doesn't come from it comes because of your love. And so if you love people and you want to help people, the people that want to be helped you become significant because they're so thankful. And so it's really like giving back. And when I say I don't do anything that's profitable, I want to give you another end of it. It's not all money profit for me, but if it's a business thing, it is money profit. But if I'm able to help somebody, and whether it's something big, small, whatever they're doing, but they're going after their dreams, and I see them accomplishing their dreams, that to me is profitable.
Of course. I have to say, if I had put everything on red, I'd have lost everything because I thought you were going to say God, to be honest. And I'm sure our listeners would be thinking the same.
Well, I think anybody that knows me knows that it is God. That's my
Yeah, I know. I know it is. But what a wonderful, wonderful answer that was to say you are so grateful to authors. I mean, yeah. But look, Gerald, before I wrap up, where can people find you? Where would you like people to find you? It sounds like no one, anyone, you don't need anyone else to find you.
Yeah. So our website, Cana, C-A-N-A, global.org.
Gerald Duran, well, what can we say? We have absolutely devoured every word that you said. We've loved it. Thank you so much for giving up your time. We appreciate you very much. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you.
It's an honor. I loved it was a challenging conversation. I loved it.